live from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of room and innuendo, all offered by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Amara Enya, Michael Lotus, Dave Lundy, and Kristen McQuarrie. Our program tonight, coming to our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8029. That's 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And if you want to join us on the World Wide Web, beyondthebeltway.com, the audio and video portion of this program. And again, there's just one day to go before the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. We have lots to talk about. It's been a busy day. 106 days to go before Election Day. And again, the big story today is that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chairman of the DNC, she has been forced to resign, and she says that she's going to gavel the convention and to order and then close it and maybe say a few words to the convention. I think there's a lot of people that are questioning whether that's what is going to happen. Dave Lundy, you're one of our Democrats here tonight. Your reaction to Debbie Wasserman's decision, it's her decision allegedly at the moment, that she's still going to address that crowd. Is that a good idea?
To address the crowd? No, it's a terrible idea, and I don't think she's actually going to do it.
Right.
Because if she does it, the cacophony of boos will be overwhelming. I think it was appropriate for her to resign, but I say this as somebody who has thought she has not done a very good job and was surprised that she was reappointed. I think that she should have been out a long time ago. That said, the coordination, all of the allegations, and I've read things from all kinds of Bernie supporter friends, and I have yet to see one single email that demonstrated a material impact on any state election, on any race whatsoever. The biggest thing that they did, we all knew what they did, which is that they made this ridiculous debate schedule that was designed to help Hillary and hurt Bernie.
I want to talk about that as an unfold, but I do want to ask one follow-up. The fact that she says that she's going to open and close it and give a talk, and, you know, we're at 10 minutes after 6 Central Time on the eve of the convention, is this a demonstration of Hillary Clinton not stepping up to make sure that she doesn't speak, or the President of the United States who hired her picking up the phone and saying, Debbie, I don't care what your 3 o'clock Sunday press conference or email or tweet said, you're not speaking.
I think it's
and they dropped the ball.
Well, I'm not sure, because I think it's a demonstration of a little bit of a fluidity in the situation. The fact that she's resigning is undoubtedly due to the fact that she got no support from Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or anybody today.
No.
I mean, it was done.
Non-stop on the air.
I don't think you've heard the last word on whether she will be speaking.
Kristen McQuarrie, I want to get your reaction from the Chicago Tribune, your reaction to the story, the way it's being handled thus far.
The story of Debbie Wasserman.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's getting the coverage it deserves. You know, we saw all during the campaign Bernie supporters and Bernie himself talking about this coordination, and you saw some element of the DNC really trying to deny it, and now you have emails showing that there was some sort of favoritism to help her, and these are supposed to be nonpartisan groups. Now, at the same time, if WikiLeaks gets a hand on Rentz Priebus's emails, I think he would be nervous too. I think there is an inherent interest in some of these party organizations to try to drive the conversation or try to help their candidate. We certainly saw a huge dust up on the Republican side.
Right.
So I don't know that it's that unusual, but she has to go. I mean, this was proof that there was some effort on their part to
help Hillary. I want to follow up to you. She has to go. The fact that she isn't officially gone yet, should we look at this and ask Hillary Clinton, why is it taking her so long to pick up the phone and get Debbie out of Philadelphia?
Well, I'm guessing there are some procedural issues that, because this is kicking off tomorrow, they might actually need her to gavel in and gavel out. I don't think she should speak. She's going to steal, you know, she's going to turn the convention into more of a circus if she does. But there might be some procedural things that we're not yet aware of that she does need to stay in that spot.
Amara Enya, you are a Democrat. You were a Bernie Sanders supporter. Your reaction to this story and how it's being handled and how it might affect Bernie Sanders supporters in the streets.
Well, frankly, I'm not surprised that Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned. I think the emails that came out only further solidified a lot of what many Bernie Sanders supporters had in their minds about a rigged, quote unquote, election. I mean, everything from the debate schedule to just a lot of what happened over the course of these campaigns really showed that there was a strong favoritism toward Hillary Clinton. Now, whether there was a material outcome with any specific election has not been proven. So I definitely don't think that has been the case. But it has really called into question Debbie Wasserman Schultz's leadership capability. And so this doesn't come as a surprise to me. I think she becomes a distraction if she speaks at the convention. And so I do think it's still a little bit fluid. I think there's something might change.
Do you think other heads have to roll? I mean, the emails that were quoted on the air were the head of the finance committee of the DNC, and he was the one that raised the issue of, you know, whether Bernie Sanders was a Jew or an atheist, that was information that conceivably could have been used in a campaign.
I think other heads will roll, and not in as public a way as Debbie Wasserman Schultz, because obviously she's sort of the head of this entire process. But I think things will happen behind the scenes, but it's left to be said who will take the fall.
Michael Lotus, you are pro-Trump. Your reaction. What about this chaos in this other party? Are you shocked by this?
No, I'm not shocked by it. It's interesting to see these emails come out. Just as we were coming on, I noticed a news story that someone's bringing a class action lawsuit against the DNC to recover the funds that Bernie supporters gave. And they quoted language from the bylaws, which I actually looked through this afternoon and on my phone and didn't notice this, but it looks like they were in violation of their own rules the way they did this.
In what way?
They are not supposed to show favoritism between candidates who are running for the Democrat nomination. Now, it's a lot of material to go through, but you have to think not only Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but other people who are involved in things that are in violation of the Democrats' own rules now not only should go because for politically, but they now present a litigation risk. They should probably just purge the people out and settle that case.
But is that
more heads have to roll, Michael?
Yes.
David.
Yes. More heads need to roll. But I'm curious if those bylaws say that about all candidates at all levels, because if they do, and if the Republicans have similar rules, then there could be litigation all over the place, because it is not remotely uncommon for the party committees to, you know, express their preference or put their thumb on the scale.
No doubt that's the case. But what we have here is a situation. We have a private organization that wouldn't be FOIA-able usually,
right.
But this stuff has now been made public.
Right.
Now, maybe both parties should agree to be more transparent and prevent this sort of thing, but that's not what we're facing today.
And also, again, the stories that have been out thus far are dealing with two or three emails. I mean, there were close to 20,000 emails. It's going to take a while for the media or the Republicans or anyone else or any investigators to go through that.
You also saw there were some emails even from political reporters who were, one in particular, who was sending his copy to the DNC first to be reviewed before he even sent it on to his editors. So I think they're going to... It was
Ken
a political
Vogel.
Reporter.
It was Ken Vogel.
I mean, that's such a violation of, like, journalistic principle that maybe there will be more coming from these emails than, you know, just entangling the DNC folks.
David, I mean, this is...
I mean, the most of the bias that was shown in these emails was expressions of opinion. And it was expression of opinion by people, communications people, finance people, other people. But it was not, again, what I'm struggling with on this whole scandal. And let's not forget, this has been done by the Russian government. They were the ones who hacked this, and they are the ones who are pushing this out.
That is what Hillary's campaign manager is alleging.
It's
but
also
I'm going to wait to hear some
experts. I want
to
come back and follow up.
We've got
to follow up. Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
From the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much. Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, as she heads out the door, they've announced that Donna Brazile will leave her position at CNN, and she will be stepping in and be the interim head of the DNC. Right before the break, Dave, you were making the point where that you were following up on something that campaign manager Robbie Mook said on a couple of interviews today. He's the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton, and he said that there was a leak between the Russian hackers. Basically gave the information to WikiLeaks, and they released all this information on the eve of the convention to help Donald Trump. And you want to double down on that. Is that correct?
Absolutely, I want to double down on that, because the question was raised, well, is this just an allegation of the Clinton campaign? And I will refer back to when the hacking was discovered in mid-June, there was no pushback that the Russians hacked the DNC. I don't remember anybody saying, whoa, hang on, the Russians didn't do it. So the fact that it came by way of WikiLeaks, obviously they got it from the hackers, who were the Russians. And if hackers give WikiLeaks something, are we to expect that the intent was not for it to be distributed? I mean, it's like saying, hey, I got on the airplane and was shocked when it took off. I mean, that's the point.
Mm-hmm. But it's only a problem because the content of the emails is an embarrassment. I mean,
well, sure, but it's
right.
That's not the only problem. The other problem is that it's a Russian government attempt to influence a U.S. election.
I mean, just as of a couple of hours ago, though, you don't have a major news source confirming yet. I mean, I think your June reference to the hacking, is accurate. There's no pushback about that, but there's been no confirmation that this specific dump is from the Russian government. And I mean, you had stories not too long ago where a reporter was on an airplane and someone sitting behind him hacked into his email while he was sitting behind him on an airplane. And as he was walking off, told him, by the way, I just hacked into your email account.
So you're suggesting that the Russian government, even though we know for a fact that they hacked these emails?
I'm saying it's not confirmed in this case neutral source.
By the way, today when Robbie made that point, he made it for. I saw it first on with Jake Tapper, but he was on other shows as well. Actually, it was on Meet the Press, and then he was on with George. He was all over the place.
And by the way, before Robbie Mook. I mean, I made this point Thursday on WGN Radio because it was well known. This was the path.
Well, again, about a month ago on this program, I said. We know because of the article you mentioned that I believe there's about 30,000 emails that the Russians have. And I was wondering, when are we going to see the mischief by Vladimir Putin? Now, to me, if this leads to – obviously this is an embarrassment to the Democrats. The DNC loses her position. It infuriates Bernie Sanders supporters, who might already be infuriated because maybe they didn't like the pick of Tim Kaine either. There's a variety of reasons why they might be infuriated. But I guess a concern I would have is that if she becomes president of the United States, are there other things in those emails that are far more damaging that could be used as blackmail? Is this sort of small potatoes compared to what they might know?
Well, there's been so much speculation on Hillary Clinton for the emails, the email scandal before this email scandal. I mean, what is going to come out, I think, is coming out now, and there are many things that could come out after the election. But I think the big challenge that she had was always the trust deficit. It was always the transparency factor and whether she was trustworthy as a candidate. That has extended since the beginning of her campaign. So even something coming out after the election, I don't think it's going to be a huge – I don't think it'll be a huge deal.
But the point is – what I'm saying is maybe it doesn't come out. I mean, if something is being used for blackmail, blackmail can be used either to release things or not release things.
Yeah, but that's wildly speculative. I mean
– it is. There's no question that it is speculative. I state that up front. The one thing that I was a little disappointed today, especially with Jake Tapper, and he's the one that I'll single out – when he was making – he made the charge. Robbie Mook, the campaign manager for Hillary Clinton, made the charge three times in a short interview, and he referred to the experts. According to the experts, this is what's happening, or this is what happened. He never once asked, who are the experts? I was sitting there. I was.
That's
I was,
all I'm saying. It might well be true, but I just I don't think. I mean, they are spinning. They are heading into They're spinning. They're heading into their convention, and they have this little explosion that they're trying to put out. So, I mean, I'm just not going to, you know, say that that's confirmed information at this
another
point about this particular.
That, right. There's another theme that's going on. Is that a lot of people's emails are insecure? We had the Office of Personnel Management hack. This is becoming a genuine problem across the board for private business entities like the political parties and throughout the government. And so we may see more and more of this sort of thing.
The other thing that Mook said today was that he questioned the timing. He said he didn't think it was coincidental that this information came out on the eve of the convention, following the convention in Cleveland, where, in his opinion, the Republican platform basically weakened NATO and all the comments that Donald Trump is making about NATO. He implied that basically Trump wants to weaken NATO, maybe as a way to assist Vladimir Putin. Now that's a pretty far-fetched speculation, but I'm not saying that it isn't possible. But I mean, that's what he was putting in the water today, far more than just they stole the emails.
Well, I certainly don't think that it was a coincidence, the timing of the release of the emails. Now, extending that back to Trump having sort of a master plan to make sure that it's released because of what happened during the RNC or his agenda, I don't necessarily buy that, but I think it was very intentional releasing those emails now, especially given the climate within the DNC.
Well, and I want to take issue with something you just said,
okay,
because you're suggesting there was a leap made that the Trump people were trying to soften things for Russia. The reality was that the Trump people were the ones who deleted the language from the RNC platform that called for aggressively defending Ukraine and supplying Ukraine with weapons.
Okay. Right.
That was not a myth. That was the folks who represent Donald Trump. And again, going back to Paul Manafort, who today in his interview denied that there was any connection between himself and anybody in the Trump campaign and the Russian government.
Except
just to be clear, because you've been on this show for several years, I just want to be clear that what I'm hearing you say tonight or allege tonight, do you believe that Russia and Russia intelligence agents, in concert with WikiLeaks, were behind the release of this information, and one of the reasons why they might have done it is that the Republicans and Donald Trump may have had some quid pro quo in making life easier for Vladimir Putin.
No, I think you've just put two things together that are not together.
Pull
I think
off the table
the first
what you
part,
don't believe.
The first part that the Russian agents, Russian government, and was coordinated with WikiLeaks to release this to embarrass Hillary Clinton and the Democrats on the eve of their convention, 100%, absolutely. If you don't have confirmation yet, I guarantee it's coming out.
Do you believe that?
I'm not sure I believe. I would feel comfortable seeing it confirmed. But what I do believe is that there's no coincidence the timing of the release of the emails. But everything else, I would have to see it confirmed before making.
Would you agree that there's no coincidence in politics?
I can almost agree with that statement. Yeah.
Michael, go ahead.
We can think of other people who have incentives to do this, too. Someone who was a strong Bernie supporter who had access to this material. Lots of people can hack things. And as far as Trump's being someone Putin loves, Trump is also pushing the NATO countries to increase their defense spending to 2% of GNP, which would be a disaster for Putin. So it's not unambiguously clear that Trump is great for Putin.
When we say that Russian intelligence and leaking the information through WikiLeaks, are we really talking about Edward Snowden, do you think?
I don't know that we're talking about Edward Snowden, but I think everybody at the table is saying something that has merit. The timing is obviously suspicious, but I agree with Michael that there are a lot of people who might have had access to this information and wanted it to get out there and wanted to, you know, put a crimp in the beginning of the convention.
And even sort of nonpartisan interests. I mean, this could be because there's been so much speculation around this election in particular in terms of it being rigged or the fix already being in. So I can see even at some other party that's not connected with the Hillary Clinton campaign or the Trump campaign as having an interest in putting this out there for the sake of transparency. agency and to force a conversation about the integrity of our election.
And to animate and Bernie supporters. I mean, this is they're trying to bring unity. And if you want to stir up Bernie supporters at this convention, this is exactly how you would do
it. And they're supposed to, allegedly, they're having 100,000 people in the streets of Philadelphia. Literally, as we speak tonight, you know, demonstrating, or I guess maybe throughout the week, the numbers are going to go great. I want to ask a journalist a question to you. 20,000 emails. How does the journalism community delve into that, Kristen?
It's not easy. I mean, literally page by page.
Sure.
And Michael and I were talking about this before the broadcast, just how we don't learn our lessons in politics. Everything you write in an email, you should expect is going to be a front page news story. And we saw this even in our own city in Chicago. The Chicago Tribune sued Mayor Rahm Emanuel and has been trying to get a handle on his, trying to get some of his emails. They come over very redacted. But we saw just last week that there were emails back and forth that included some really disparaging comments that our governor made about Chicago school teachers.
Right.
So it's also just this kind of knock on the forehead moment, you know, when are you going to learn your lesson? Do not send emails that you wouldn't want to see made public.
I always advise people that of exactly that. I'm like, don't write things in an email that you don't want to see on the front page of the Tribune.
And as a lawyer, you want those documents produced, and there you go through their emails. And as to 20,000 emails, you do word searches, you look for specific dates, you start with that, you try to go to some key locations, and then you have to fan out. And sometimes just near the end, you find something good you weren't looking for.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont, looking for your calls. 1-800-723-8029. Where do you come down on the drop of the emails? These are the emails. Remember when Bernie Sanders says, I'm sick and tired of your damn emails? He was talking about the wrong emails. He should have been calling after Debbie Wasserman Schultz's emails. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Back shortly.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and you were just going to make a point, Dave Lundy, our Democrat, and you were going to make a point about how Bernie Sanders reacted to all this when he was on three or four shows today.
Yeah, I saw him on two of the shows, and he was unequivocal. He said that you know, obviously it's disappointing, but it didn't surprise him because of the what they knew and what they suspected. And again, the most obvious thing was the debate scheduling. But he said, "Look, if my supporters think that voting for a guy who would undo everything we care about is a good idea, I would encourage them to basically think again." He didn't say you must vote for Hillary, but he said my number one priority right now is defeating Donald Trump because he's the worst nominee I've ever seen.
When you hear that, and you're a Bernie supporter, does it really matter to you what the candidate, how the candidate reacts? Because I mean, he's a professional politician. You're involved in politics. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of young people, many of whom may be in the streets of Philadelphia tonight. This is their first campaign. They don't know that you're supposed to roll over and kiss and make up when a primary is over. I mean, can they be really moved, you think?
I think they can. I mean, the role as leader, Senator Sanders does have a responsibility to set the tone. And I think he's done a good job of that. I mean, he's really stuck on a message about unifying behind the candidate, about the issues and keeping focused on the issues. And I think that's why he's coming out so strong against Donald Trump, because Trump, again, is against everything that Senator Sanders campaigned on. So I think he's he's done his job and he's been
not
doing
trade,
a good
though.
Job.
Not mm-hmm. trade.
On well, but
what about trade and the role of big money in politics? Aren't they on the same side?
Well, I think so. Donald Trump has been taking advantage of a couple of things that he is trying to pull Bernie supporters onto his bandwagon for. But I think overall, Senator Sanders has been very clear that Trump cannot be the president of the United States, and that Hillary Clinton is the better of the two candidates. And he, I think, has done a responsible job of setting that tone for his supporters. And I think it makes a difference.
At this moment, I want to just mention, you know, where we are insofar as the polls. A couple of weeks ago on this program, I said that I would not share any national polls that did not include Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, and Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate. And so I'm keeping my campaign promise. Let's take a look at the polls. This is the four-way race as of the moment. These are real clear politics averages. Hillary Clinton at 41.2%, Donald Trump at 38.3%, Gary Johnson a solid 8%, or an even 8%, I should say, and Jill Stein at 3.8% at this particular moment. And again, the following through on that is to where Bernie Sanders voters might go. But again, a poll involving Bernie Sanders will show, Fritz, if we'll go to the next slide. These are Sanders supporters and their choice as of the moment. 57%, which is a goodly number, but not as impressive as some would like. 57% for Clinton, 23% going to Gary Johnson, 12% going to the more liberal Jill Stein, and only 5% going to Donald Trump, which that's a number that I thought was probably is about right. So 57%, that's a good number. It's not a great number, Kristen.
It's a solid number. I mean, I don't see that constituency. They're definitely not going to Trump. I don't think they're going to the Green Party. Gary Johnson is getting a little bit of momentum, but he's still somebody who's out there talking about slashing entitlement programs, returning grant programs to the state. That is not something that appeals to the Democratic base. I think all this consternation about where Bernie supporters are going to go is a little overblown. They're going to vote for Hillary. I mean, I don't see any other path.
These numbers showed 30% of them going to third party candidates, which is, I think, pretty striking, actually.
I think I agree. I'm inclined to agree. The attraction of a Bernie Sanders campaign was the fact that he had authentic rhetoric that really spoke to a population in this country that feels that they have not been represented by establishment candidates. And so it makes sense that when you have the presumptive nominee in Clinton, who is the epitome of the establishment candidate, that a lot of people who felt very strongly about Senator Sanders are looking for another alternative, hence Gary Johnson and Jill Stein.
It would be interesting to know, for example, 1980 you had Ted Kennedy challenge Jimmy Carter, and Kennedy fought hard but lost. I can't imagine that only 57% of his supporters were going for Jimmy Carter, because basically we fought, we lost, we were the true liberal progressives, but we lost. I have to think they must have all just gone on board the train. The Bernie supporters, especially the young folks, are a different breed, and they're not real happy with Hillary. And the fact that she's only getting 57 and is still an opening there for someone like Gary Johnson is interesting.
Yeah, I actually agree. I mean, I think that when you look at those numbers, I don't think Hillary Clinton has done the job yet with the Bernie supporters. I don't think this email scandal is Debbiegate is going to help. And I think that at the end of the day, a lot of those people are going to wind up voting for Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. I mean, heck, Kristen, your newspaper came out and said you have a choice. There's, you know, they're good third party candidates. And
he needs to get in the debates, though. I mean, if he doesn't even get on a debate stage, he's going to fade very quickly, and he's just not going to get the kind of exposure that people will gravitate toward him. I don't think most Bernie supporters really know that much about Gary Johnson right now. So
I wonder. Let me ask you a question. You were on the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune, one of the major newspapers in the United States, and I want to tell you what I've said on this program. To me, that if a candidate is on enough states where they can mathematically get to 270 electoral votes, and they demonstrate some support. I've said 10%. I think some are holding at a higher threshold. If you can get to 10%, you should be in those debates. Because what's going on in this country, there is an upheaval. It's an upheaval on the right. It's an upheaval on the left. I mean, there's stuff going on in this country. And television is the great decider in some respects. So I'm wondering whether newspapers, and I'm not asking you to make an editorial position. You got to talk with your friends at the Tribune first. But, I mean, the newspapers of America, because the other group that I would like to see statistics on is Where are all the moderate to liberal, or I guess there are not many liberal Republicans, where are the moderate Republicans going to go? The people that were not excited and are not excited, the people that walked, either didn't watch the convention. I mean, the suburban, you know, soccer moms. Where are they going? I would be as much interested in where their split is as the split we've just described in the Democratic Party. But I agree with you. Gary Johnson should be in those debates, and so should Jill Stein if they get to 10%.
Right. I mean, so you're talking to somebody who is at a newspaper who, when we do endorsements, we interview every single person. If you are on the ballot, you at least get a phone call. You get a 15-minute interview. I understand the dilemma that a lot of the television stations have. I mean, we saw with the Republican primary. When you have such a crowded stage, it really doesn't serve anyone. You have to have some way of filtering. But if Gary Johnson can prove that he's viable and that they can get enough, you know, put enough pressure on some of the major debate hosts like CNN and Fox, then absolutely he should be on the debate stage.
I want to ask a follow-up since you're here. Were you in the editorial board discussion with Donald Trump within a couple of weeks after he announced last June?
Yes.
Okay. What was your reaction to what he was saying to you and the Tribune and your colleagues at the Tribune that day, specifically as it related to illegal immigration and the crime that he believed was tied to illegal immigration?
You know, he came to the Tribune shortly after he announced, and we, like probably every news outlet, really did not think that he was going to be much of a viable candidate.
Right.
So the conversation was a little bit more Chicago-focused. We talked about Trump Tower. We talked about the sign on his building. We did get into issues, but I wouldn't say that we pressed him as much as we would have another candidate had we known. We have all been wrong about him this entire election cycle. But I will tell you, I walked away from that meeting feeling that he was actually, I think it was Ben Carson who said there's two Donald Trumps, the one you see on stage who's very aggressive and the one who's actually more of a human being in person. We definitely saw the human being side of him. He was much more knowledgeable about certain subjects, trade, China, than we expected. China. But he was charming. I mean, he left that room and we were all a little bit surprised at what we saw.
I will tell you, I was shocked because the news coverage of the rhetoric that he used when he announced talking about illegal immigration and those coming from Mexico, it was startling. And then about a week later, I guess, or a couple of 10 days later, you know, when he met with the Tribune, your colleague and boss, Bruce Dold, who's now the editor of the Tribune, is a good friend of mine, on his Facebook page, he ran the entire interview. It was up there. And I sat and I watched. I said it on the program. I said, you should really go and watch the entire thing. Because on the issue of crime and the number and the relationship between crime and illegal immigrants, he had chapter and verse. He had all kinds of papers. He was turning to his assistants. He had, in my view, based on he was well prepared, and he was giving you chapter and verse on the relationship between illegal immigrants and crime. I mean, he's alluded to it obviously a couple of times. He alluded to it last week. He's alluded to it even on a broader stage in California when he surrounded himself by victims of illegal immigration. But to me, he seemed very reasonable and a guy who had his facts at least.
We fact-checked him a little bit on that, and some of what he said was not accurate. And I think when you are coming off of an announcement speech where you make the accusation that, you know, a lot of people coming from Mexico are not good people, they are right. This, they are that, they are rapists, that sort of clouds whatever you want to say beyond that to tie immigrants to illegal.
We have callers on the line. Let's go to Kevin listening to us on KLBJ in Austin, Texas. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I do. Glad you guys discussed the fact that I think a lot of millennials, a lot of disappointed Bernie supporters are going to go green or libertarian. And I even know Republican friends of mine who still live up in the Chicago area, they think that Trump won't be able to win Illinois, so they're going to vote libertarian. So I think both those dynamics are going to be very important.
I'm inclined to agree. I mean, I think the question is, what does the future look like, particularly for the DNC? I mean, this election, I think, has been a watershed election in terms of what the future of the Democratic Party looks like. And a lot of millennials are not necessarily buying into the two-party system either, and they're not buying into this binary choice that they have. And so the Green Party, the Libertarian Party are both viable options for them.
Okay, thanks for your call. Quick answer. Thus far, the platform, are you satisfied with what Bernie got in that platform?
some, but not all.
Okay, I want to come back and talk more about that. 1-800-723 from coast to coast and border to border around the world on beyondthebeltway.com. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Hey, Bruce.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Don't forget, we will be talking about what happened in Cleveland last week as well. But again, the focus at the moment is what's happening in the future and what is happening right now, and also what happened yesterday. Tim Kaine, former governor and senator, lieutenant governor, and mayor of Richmond, Virginia, a very well-liked man, was selected by Hillary Clinton. Let me ask my Bernie Sanders supporter, what do you think of that selection?
Well, my first reaction was uninspired. And I've talked to a lot of my colleagues who are Bernie Sanders supporters, and they were uninspired, not excited. I think a lot of people don't know that much about Tim Kaine and didn't know about his background. And so the pick, part of it is just the optics of it, right? You've got Tim Kaine and you've got Hillary Clinton. People are looking for candidates that they can identify with, a candidate they can galvanize.
When you say optics, you mean they're both white?
They're both white.
Okay.
Both establishment. And again, this is a campaign. This is an election where anti-establishment rhetoric and sentiment is very strong. So my first reaction was, okay. But knowing Tim Kaine's background, I can see why he was the pick for the Democratic Party.
Dave Lundy.
I have to tell you, people kept asking me, well, who do you want as VP? And I'm like, I don't care. I'm like, other people I don't want, but I don't really care who you pick. Kaine would be fine. And then yesterday, I happened to be out on a bike ride, and I was listening. I caught the entire event with Hillary Clinton's speech and Tim Kaine's speech, and I have to tell you, I was blown away. I was absolutely blown away. He was phenomenal. He's described as boring, but the Yiddish expression is he's Hamish. He came across as genuine and warm and human. I didn't know about his background that he had spent, 17 years as a lawyer. Having graduated from Harvard Law School, he chose to go defend against housing discrimination. After his first year at Harvard, he went down to Honduras to do missionary work. He was just so effective in that speech. And I'm like, I went from being mediocre, lukewarm to, wow, this guy is really good.
I heard the speech also, and I thought he was good. I thought it was solid. I wasn't blown away by it. It did a good job of revealing more about who he is and why he is a solid pick. However, just the fact of Tim Kaine as vice president, we have to think about the context of this. We're coming off of the first African-American president in the country. You're also coming off of an election with Hillary Clinton, who has not done a good job of exciting Democrats, exciting millennials, exciting people to support her. So people were looking for someone who could galvanize people, and the initial reaction was underwhelming.
Michael.
I thought the Tim Kaine pick was a wise, safe, practical pick for Hillary Clinton. He's a straight down the line progressive Democrat. He's got an interesting backstory. He's not going to embarrass her. And as far as having a person of color or someone else, we've got the first woman president. She does have to try to get Caucasian voters who maybe are not going to be whatever she's concerned about. The blue-collar, white male blue-collar voters who are all flocking to Trump, maybe she wants to try to get some of those back. I don't know.
Kristen, to me, he was the perfect pick for a candidate that needs to energize suburban soccer moms and moderate Republicans.
Right. I mean, she has her base. We all know it's the people in the middle, it's the independents that are going to decide this election. And he is, he was described as being establishment. Well, yes, but he's really genuine, and I think that's what came across in the speech. He has worked with Republicans. He's a little bit more moderate. And also, I think something gets overlooked. I mean, a lot of times when presidential candidates are choosing a running mate, they have to choose someone with whom they're very comfortable. And a lot of the choice depends on just the rapport that the two of them have together. You don't want to end up with a Sarah Palin. And so I think she was smart in choosing someone who is authentic, genuine, maybe will loosen her up a little bit, and also has a strong record.
Because of the lack of apparent enthusiasm in the African-American community for Hillary Clinton, I suggested last week on this program that I thought that Cory Booker would have been a stronger candidate, would have energized the African-American vote, because the African-American vote has to be very enthusiastic. There's no way I think you're going to get to, the Barack Obama levels. The Hispanic vote, I never thought that Perez or Castro was going to be a candidate, because the energy within the Hispanic community, if they don't have that with what Donald Trump is saying, they're never going to have it. So to me, Booker was the one to give the energy to drive the turnout. Your reaction to that, because it seems to me that she weighed that against whether or not, by picking Tim Kaine, she might be able to get more Republican crossover votes that really do not like Donald Trump.
I never believed that Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, or any other senator from a state with a Republican governor was going to be the pick, because there is no way, when we're on the precipice of regaining the Senate, that we were going to give one seat away. I just didn't believe that. So, and it doesn't mean I don't think they took it seriously and they evaluated it. And Cory Booker is an incredibly compelling senator. But I just don't think you're going to give away the Senate. I think Democrats recognize if you want to actually get something done, you need to do that.
But when you have Bernie Sanders supporters and you have African-American supporters that are integral, probably the most viable and most volatile aspect of the Democratic constituency, the message that's also being sent is that, okay, I'm 69 years old. I may not run again if I am elected. And I'm really putting in place the future of the Democratic Party. I'm saying for the next 4, 8, or 12 years, I'm going to select a 58-year-old white, moderate, moderate liberal. That's the future of the Democratic Party. And I'm thinking, where do Hispanics and where do African Americans, how do they react to, again, the optics that you referenced?
Well, this is a critical conversation that I think needs to happen in the Democratic Party, but also with progressives. And it is this question of leadership. I mean, we've seen this happen not just at the national level, but also right here in Chicago, in terms of when it comes down to actual courting of votes, does the Democratic Party and even progressives take for granted African-American voters, Latino voters? I mean, even with Tim Kaine's selection, he was lauded because he speaks Spanish, which is great. Right, I speak Spanish, but it doesn't replace having an actual Latino on the ticket, right? And the way it was so overblown in their discussing him led me to that question again: do we take for granted people of color within the Democratic Party and even progressives?
Okay, 1-800-723-8289. We got a great group tonight, lots to talk about. 1-800-723-8289. If you want to email me a comment, Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. You want to send me a tweet at Dumo, at Dumo. And if you want to watch us, continue to watch us on the World Wide Web. It's beyondthebeltway.com.
The answer to your question is yes.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amlinks Interior Landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlinks now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Saturdays at 4:30 and Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Well, as the Democrats continue to sort out how they're going to get Debbie Wasserman Schultz out of Philadelphia without saying a word, I want to switch to what was happening in Cleveland last week. And I want to talk with you, Michael. Obviously, you are our Trump supporter tonight. But on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being a grand slam home run, how did he do in your mind?
With the speech.
With the speech.
I give it an 8. It was the Trump speech. It was the long version. It was the coherent version. It was free of extemporizing. It told his fans what they wanted to hear. He tried, I think, to reach out to people with his themes of public safety and talking about terrorism and things like this. This notion of safety and security seems to be a big way he's going to try to reach into the center of the voting community.
Kristen, you were there reporting for the Chicago Tribune. You've heard a lot of political speeches. Did Donald Trump say anything that will alleviate any fears that people have about him, in your view?
No, I think he doubled down on them. It wasn't too different. I had printed out his announcement speech when he first announced he was running last June, and he didn't deviate too much from that speech. He just kept out some of the, he had accused Mexican illegal immigrants of being rapists. He didn't go that far. But in terms of just like that fire and brimstone, he has not backed down from his position on illegal immigration. He did not back down on law and order. He did not back down on just speaking in a way that's very conversational and not cleansed, which I think will be very different from what we hear from Hillary Clinton.
He didn't say Mexico was going to pay for the wall, though.
But he said he's still going to build a wall.
Right.
He is sticking with the actual bricks and mortar concept of trying to build a wall. So, I mean, I just thought it was, he's not going to pivot. Everyone was kind of waiting for this pivot where he's going to become this more messaged candidate, and he did not do that.
Was his comments on Muslims, however, as opposed to banning all Muslims from coming to the country, was it somewhat nuanced in that he said that he would focus on specific countries that had a track record of terrorism? Was that a slight pullback from his position?
I mean, I suppose he tried to nuance a lot of what he has been saying all along, and with a lot of this regard, he tried to keep reaching out to the LGBTQ community. You could see him kind of the wheels turning in his head to make sure.
That doesn't exactly roll off your tongue.
It doesn't. That's
I mean,
true.
I think they have,
especially
they,
when you're not used to saying
right.
it.
Yes.
No, but even if you're used to saying it, it's kind of it's
LGBT.
Yeah.
There,
but,
I did
but,
it.
But he did the no, but the Q. He put the Q in there too.
Yeah, the Q. Right.
But you could see
it'd be
there
much
was
easier if it was BLT.
Made it for an uncomfortable conversation.
Right.
The most famous sandwich in the world, the BLTQ. Go ahead.
Made for an uncomfortable conversation with my mom, who asked what the Q was.
Yeah, right.
I'll just
so I mean, I thought it was a good speech. It was he did not deviate from Donald Trump. He just tried to activate the base, which I think a lot of people were thinking maybe he was going to start to be more messaged, and he did not.
Dave, I want to ask you, because we brought up the LGBTQ issue, does he get any credit for referencing gays and treating gays with some degree of respect and protecting them, which is not something you normally hear from a Republican candidate, and you certainly don't have an openly gay man, you know, Peter Thiel, addressing the convention?
Well, I would say he would get credit if credit is the absence of criticism. So I think that is about as far as it goes. I don't know how the log cabin Republicans feel about Donald Trump. Interestingly, on the Muslim ban, he, as he said this morning on Chuck Todd, he didn't back off of it. He actually believes he has expanded it by talking about all countries where there have been issues. And Chuck Todd asked the logical extension, which is, does this mean you're going to ban people from France? Does this mean you're going to ban Muslims who are coming from France or
and he
from
said
Germany?
No.
No, he did not say no, Bruce.
No. What he said is that he wants to, you know, look at that and clarify and be sure that everything is properly vetted, is what he said.
Mm-hmm. Well, right, but he also said that we might. He said we might ban people from France and from European countries that have problems, and he wants to implement extreme vetting. But, you know, look, Donald Trump is very good at sloganeering. He's very good at throwing these slogans out there that have no meat behind them. We don't know what extreme vetting is. It's a meaningless phrase.
I don't know if it's meat.
Do you think it's a meaningless phrase, extreme?
I think it's an easy phrase. It's something that's easy to say.
It's not like extremely careless, which is what James Comey said about Hillary Clinton.
Well, extreme vetting, but what does that look like? How do you operationalize that? And how do you operationalize that? And who is going to ask him to do so? I think one of the things that Donald Trump has gotten away with is not being called out on his lack of substance. A lot of things he's been able to say are just put out there. And a lot of his supporters aren't asking for more because they're more interested in the sloganeering, the phrases that speak to them emotionally.
I disagree with that, though. I mean, you have National Review Online, a very conservative publication that has been fighting him at every turn. Yeah. I don't know that Hillary Clinton gets called out on the substance of what she says. Yeah. She makes grand, they all do. I mean,
they make
these grand
politics
remarks about this.
Also,
but I think he has been put through the ringer for lack of substance, even, you know, specifically and most difficultly from the right.
You're not going to have a candidate getting too deep into the weeds and the details of some policy change. I think what Trump is saying, and he's been pretty consistent about this, and he's over the top in how he phrases things, is we do not feel like we're secure. We do not feel like we have adequate control over who comes into the country, and we want to change that. I don't think that's unreasonable, and that's what I think voters aren't going to think is unreasonable either.
But also language does matter. Rhetoric matters, and he has, throughout the course of his campaign, used rhetoric that has incited violence at his rallies, rhetoric that has emboldened the worst of society to come out with basically vitriol, and that's something that
What are the specific references that you're talking about?
So the rhetoric, so in his rallies, it's in his rallies in particular where people have been kicked, punched, spat upon, where he has not taken responsibility. He has not shown leadership by calling that out. Instead, he has egged it on. That has happened in his rallies.
I've got to disagree. What happened is fairly early on in the campaign season, they established a practice that if someone's disrupting, to step away and chant. And then the security guards removed
them. That is not that what is, happened.
Exactly
there was an African-American woman at one of his rallies who was pushed, shoved, spat upon, and literally dragged out of a Trump rally to him yelling, get him out, the way he typically does. That has happened on numerous occasions.
You had Bernie supporters even at the convention throwing bags of urine-filled balloons at police. Neither side has been angels in this. I mean, you had Bernie supporters across the country turning police cars over, throwing things at police.
Waving the Mexican flag. Maybe they weren't his supporters, but certainly.
The extremes on both sides have been
violent
and wrong.
I'd
acknowledge that?
it's not to say that anyone has been an angel. And I don't think it's either one or the other. But what has been clear, at least from what I've seen, is that at Trump's rallies, Trump's language and rhetoric has emboldened that kind of behavior. Bernie Sanders does not go on in his speeches and say rhetoric that allows a David Duke to come out and say he's going to run because racists now have a chance in this country.
At the Chicago event that didn't come off, I tried to get into that, and there's a huge number of Bernie people there, and I was talking to some. They were there to raise hell. They were there to basically prevent it from happening. Okay, look, this is Chicago. We have a history of hard-nosed activism, but you can't say that a lot of different people in all the different campaigns, especially Bernie.
But it's not the candidate. The candidates on the Democratic side have condemned this over and over and over.
Bernie didn't condemn what happened
absolutely
in Nevada?
Not. I don't know about Nevada, but he's repeatedly condemned any violence.
I don't think he did. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. More about the Republican convention when we come back.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago the other night in Cleveland. And by the way, let me just say that I went to the convention. It was my 18th convention. I thought the city of Cleveland, the law enforcement officials, the federal officials that were all there, they did a terrific job of keeping a lid on Cleveland. The organization was the best of any convention I've ever at. And Cleveland really did a terrific job, I mean, absolutely a terrific job. But I want to ask a question. Donald Trump is the law and order candidate, just in case you didn't think he was going to be. He said it over and over again, so it must be true. He's going to be the law and order candidate. When you hear someone say law and order candidate, what does it mean to you, Amara?
It's a little troubling. In fact, the whole tone of the convention I thought was troubling. I mean, it was very much about law and order, which to me sends a signal about control. It sends a signal about overreaching potentially with the state, especially in an environment where we have so much happening in our communities with the relationship between police and communities. And so to be the law and order candidate just harkens back to a time where state-sanctioned actors did things on behalf of the state that were very detrimental to targeted communities. And that, coupled with his rhetoric, is very troubling.
If you are an African-American listening to that speech on the south or west side of Chicago or in any black community anywhere in the United States, when he says he wants to make your neighborhoods safe again, how do you think they read that? Do they believe people that are not victims? And by the way, I think there's a lot of victims in the African-American community who may have been victimized by police. I think we would acknowledge, everybody would acknowledge that. But there's also a lot of African Americans who live in black communities who have not been victimized by police. Maybe the numbers are considerably larger, I would think. Would you acknowledge that? Because I'm wondering if I'm living in a ghetto somewhere in the United States and I hear someone say that they're going to protect me, they're going to make my life easier by reducing crime, it seems to me that I would hear that in a way that here's someone that may want to help me. Where am I wrong in thinking that?
Well, so making communities safer, reducing crime is not an issue of policing. It's an issue of investment in communities. I mean, crime is a symptom of many things that have not happened in particular communities, such as on the south and west side of Chicago. So to say you're going to make our communities safe again, to me, unless then you're talking about investing in communities the same way other parts of the city have been invested in, then all you're saying is something about police.
But later in the later in the same speech, he also talked about a lack of opportunity because of schools that don't work. Does that resonate?
That alone, that part resonates because the education, the quality of education and the inequity, again, that we see in our city, in Chicago, is part of the problem. These are the many things that cause crime. Crime is not a thing in and of itself. And so often when we talk about crime, it's always from the standpoint of policing, as though flooding the streets with police is going to somehow solve the crime problem. That is not a solution. So when Trump talks about law and order, and the first thing that comes to mind is police, not investments. Now.
But isn't flooding communities with police at least an immediate answer to reduce crime?
It can hardly be an immediate answer, especially when we see the number of police-involved shootings that have taken place
in
the
community. Well, Bill Clinton thought it was. That's why he wanted 10,000 police officers.
And that's why Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have come under such criticism, especially from the African-American community, because of the crime bill, because of their approach to addressing crime that has been detrimental to the African-American community. So they've been criticized for it as well. So Donald Trump coming along and saying the same things about police and the idea of flooding streets with police, that's not something that's going to be endearing anyone to his
platform. I just want to make sure I understand it. So, again, many African-Americans believe that when they beef up the police presence is going to maybe reduce crime for a while, but they are going to arrest criminals that then go into the criminal justice system, and then the complaint is there's too many African Americans going to prison.
Well, so it's not quite that simple. A lot of the issues with mass incarceration are to disparities in sentencing, targeted crimes such as marijuana possession as opposed to other crimes in other communities that are not, where people are not being sentenced. They're not being sentenced equitably. So there are a lot of prongs that lead to mass incarceration. But one thing that one thing that, at least from my standpoint, is that increasing the number of police does not guarantee safety. The only way to do that is by the necessary investments in community development, access to education, mental health services. It's a suite of things that need to happen in those communities.
Michael, is law and order an issue? Are those issues that you think are going to resonate the rest of the way?
I think that they will. I don't think they're focused on the African-American community so much. They're just focused more on people who are concerned that their suburban life is going to be disrupted, and they see police officers shot, and it's very frightening to them.
Is it more about terrorism than anything else?
Well, he's treated them as two separate issues, but they kind of all come together under whether people feel safe or not. But on the issue of trying to reach out to the African-American community, and I will venture a prediction that Donald Trump will try to get African-American votes in some fairly specific way. There's safety, school choice, which he's talked about a lot, and job opportunities. And I think he is at least going to try to make a pitch, and that's addressing some of the pieces of the puzzle you're talking about. And things he can't really do anything about is, like we see in Chicago, just extraordinary levels of distrust between people in some communities and the police force. And that's really a local problem that the president can't do anything about.
And it doesn't help matters when Donald Trump says, effectively, the police are always right.
He didn't say that.
No, he has absolutely condemned. He has condemned Black Lives Matter. He's condemned Black Lives Matter, and he views this as a binary thing. I don't think Donald Trump, to your point, I don't think Donald Trump is a credible messenger in the African American community about what is going to help their community, because he hasn't.
It's Hillary Clinton.
Stuff.
She's a hell of a lot more credible than Donald Trump.
I just think so. When you're listening to his speech, it totally depends on your life experience and where you're coming from. But when he talked about law and order and big cities like Chicago, I do see that. I mean, the victims of violent crime in Chicago are overwhelmingly minorities. And so to act like this is not a problem, or that there doesn't need to be some sense of law and order drawn back to these communities, when you have kids who are taught at a young age when they hear gunfire to drop to the floor. We've had 2,200 shootings in Chicago so far this year. These places are like war zones. And so I would think that that message in some way would resonate with that community. And Giuliani, Mayor Giuliani, not Trump, he did address the issue of officers who shoot and that's unjustified need to be punished. That is a theme that should have been much more prominent right. in the convention, and it wasn't.
But also, if we're going to talk about in the context of Chicago, you cannot talk about crime and who the victims of crime are without talking about the inequitable investment in the city. The reality is that in those very same communities where people do not have access to high-quality schools because they've either been closed mm-hmm. or the schools are inequitably funded, where mental health clinics have been shut down, mm-hmm. where the development in terms of attracting businesses to those key corridors.
The legislatures in Illinois and in many parts of the country, they're controlled by Democrats. Big cities are controlled by Democrats. Barack Obama has been president for 7.5 years. I mean, those are and by the way, Donald Trump made that point. These are legitimate things. These have happened on Barack Obama's watch as well as legislative leaders in Springfield.
And I completely agree, which is why I think that millennials are less beholden to party politics and identity politics than their predecessors, because they've seen that Chicago is a Democratic-run city, and what has that caused? What has that led to in our community?
And Dave may be right, whether it's because of how his opponents have presented him or his own style, that Trump is not going to be the credible messenger. But the day for the Republican Party to make a more conservative school choice, public safety, job creation pitch to African-American communities which have had Democrat mayors for 60 years, that is a political opening that I've been mystified why they haven't tried
and
to
Democratic
seize.
Alderman, I just have to make this point because I completely agree with Amara that these communities, they're looking for investment. You have 50 Chicago aldermen, all of them Democrats except for I think one, who only really have to control 4 square miles. And if you want to hold someone accountable for why you don't have investment in your community, you should be holding your local elected officials much more responsible than Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. I mean, we have these elected officials who are getting paid a lot of money to do to take care of a small area, and
what
they're not doing it.
Your reaction, David. The stars in Cleveland, in my view, and I think a lot of people would agree, the stars in Cleveland were the family, were the children.
And Scott Baio. Scott Baio. You can't forget Scott Baio. Chachi.
Charles in
what
charge.
What about Pat Smith? What about Pat Smith? What about Pat Smith, the mother of one of the Benghazi victims?
I think
too
that,
much.
A little bit, yeah. And I think that the part of the challenge you have, and part of the challenge, frankly, Donald Trump has, is that he says things. That there's an element. There's a kernel of truth. And then he layers on 27 steps higher than that, and he exaggerates. I mean, that entire speech. First of all, we should thank him for introducing the vocabulary word dystopian into the American vocabulary. But that was exactly my reaction. I literally walked out of the speech, walked onto the air, and said, "My God, the dystopian version of reality that he's presenting."
What about the children?
What about them? I mean, they were fine.
No,
but
did they steal the show?
No, it's not a matter of them stealing the show. Here's the thing. Say I'm a voter, and I don't like Hillary Clinton, and I like some things about Trump, but I'm troubled because he's Donald Trump and he's over the top. And I see that he's got adult children who seem like pretty good people. Like, they seem sensible. They're successful. That helps give people an impetus to say, all right, I can pull the trigger for Donald Trump. I think it was a very important contribution that they made to possibly selling him to voters who would be undecided otherwise.
They had excellent nannies.
My kids like me.
There was actually an interesting article that came out, I think, last week that talked about his daughter, Ivanka Trump. And she's been lauded and you know, very successful mm-hmm. and probably the best spokesperson for the campaign. But they drew the distinction between how Donald Trump speaks about his daughter and pushes her out as a strength in the campaign versus his wife, Melania, and the characteristics that she has as his wife that I thought was very
But again, but Melania is a little harder to understand also.
Yes, and she plagiarized her speech, which didn't do anything.
Well, that got him off to the bad start, but not quite as bad a start as Debbie Wasserman Schultz has gotten off the Democratic Party. The one thing they missed, he's a grandfather. Bring the new baby out. He should be kissing a baby. That's the one photo op they missed. Back shortly from Chicago with calls.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels. Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Back in Chicago, let's go to telephone calls. Let's go to Linda, listening to us in Redding, California on KQMS. I understand you want to talk about Donald Trump.
Yes, I do. I'm going to make this as concise as I possibly can.
Okay.
I've been listening to all the comments that everyone's been making, and there's kind of a trend from Amara that I keep hearing, that everything that you bring up and your points were very valid and exactly what I would have said to a lot of her comments. The reason I would never in a million years ever vote for Hillary Clinton is because I lost my son last year at 23 through no fault of his own, and I have recently learned about Dorothy Woods, who has a four-year-old son named Kai, who now has to grow up without his father because nobody was sent to help them in Benghazi. And Hillary Clinton stood there and talked to these people, Cheryl Bennett and Charles Woods and Dorothy, and basically said she was sorry to their face. Anybody that could do that to a mother is reprehensible, in my opinion. I know the pain and misery I went through, and nothing could happen in my life that could change that. But something could have happened here, and it didn't happen.
There have been
that
nine,
is not excusable.
There have been nine congressional investigations. Nine.
I don't care. Do you know who's in charge of the White House right now?
There have been nine investigations
I
that have all. Excuse me, ma'am.
Let's let Dave respond, and then
we'll go back
to you, Linda.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah.
Ma'am, there have been nine investigations. The military has testified repeatedly that there was nothing they could have done for the people who died in Benghazi. This was from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs on down. This is from the Secretary of Defense on down. Literally nine, and not a single one of those Republican-led investigations found that those people could have been saved.
That's not the point.
But when you have the mother of the victim saying at the convention, as she did, Hillary Clinton looked me in the eyes and lied and told me that he died because
exactly.
of a video, I do think that was a compelling moment, maybe even for people who aren't in this as much as we are, like, day to day. But if there's any measurement, my Uber driver one day, he's a Hillary Clinton supporter, but he felt that was the most impactful moment of the whole convention.
Was that speech on television? I was in the hall, so I don't know. Was Pat Smith's speech
on television? I saw it on
television. Oh, you saw it on television. Okay.
And it's also characteristic of Hillary Clinton. She didn't have to do that. She didn't have to say that to these people, and it wasn't true, or she hadn't locked
it down. Yes, she did. She's the Secretary of State.
She didn't have to say something inaccurate to them.
Nobody has to do anything.
Look,
it's called compassion.
Dave's the Democrat here, and I agree with him on this, that there wasn't much there that the congressional committees were going to nail her down on. Yet she said this ridiculous thing to these people. She constantly wrongfoots herself. She
exactly.
constantly says
things
that aren't true.
Exactly.
I think the power of this, and now I know something I did not know, and that is it was on television. Again, when you're at the convention, you don't know what's on TV and what's not. I also thought another very compelling was the lone survivor. The veteran that was there, I mean, his story, I mean, this was a guy that looked like he was about to lose it up there. He was so emotionally charged about it. And this gets to something that Kristen just alluded to, and I talked about it in the last hour. The people that are going to decide this election, you know what? There isn't anybody listening to the show tonight that's going to be in that 10%. Because on talk radio, you're either on one side or the other. The
exactly.
10% are people, again, who will casually weigh in on this. And I believe that a television commercial, just as the television commercials that are playing right now that show Donald Trump's words and kids watching on a TV screen when he's using some very blue or questionable language, is a very powerful message to mothers who have children. I also believe that taking Pat Smith's comments to the speech to the convention, cutting that into a commercial, juxtaposed to Benghazi footage, is going to be a very powerful, it's going to be made into a commercial. It's going to be a very powerful commercial that, again, that's going to be, because those 10%, the 10% who are going to decide this, they're going to vote on a motion. They're going to vote on something other than whether or not someone has a white paper on any particular subject. They're moved by the emotion of it. And there was so much emotion that came out of that convention, as there will be emotion that comes out of the Democratic convention. We're going to hear from victims of gun violence. And I believe we're going to hear from the mothers of African Americans who've been shot or killed by police officers. We're going to hear that juxtaposition. So both sides are going to have enough emotional B-roll and sound on, and that's what the airwaves of America, I think, are going to be filled with, you know, from like October 15th through Election Day.
I totally believe that.
Okay, we're going to move on. Well, Rick, go ahead. You're next, listening on Austin, Texas, KLBJ.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Bruce. I love your show. The diversity of thought and opinion is just brilliant, and your show is very unique.
Thank you.
I'm a disabled vet. I was calling about, but just because you guys were talking about it, the Benghazi thing, what disturbs me was the fact that the line about the video, when she tells her daughter, you know, it was about terrorists, and then she tells the mother, no, it was because of the video. That's did a big thing for me, but that's not what I called about. The talk earlier about Trump supporters, Trump being very disruptive at his conventions and causing a lot of, you know, hostilities and so forth. I haven't seen anywhere where Trump supporters are going to Hillary's or Bernie's events and trying to disrupt theirs. What I have seen are Hillary and Bernie supporters going to Trump's and throwing eggs at them, and as you mentioned, throwing urine. I see it completely flipped from the way it's being presented that Trump.
By the way, let me just interrupt. I know of no incident where a known supporter of Hillary Clinton was involved in that. The stories that have been written are those that were supporting Bernie Sanders. Someone referenced throwing a balloon full of urine. That is a published report. What I can tell you is what I saw with my own eyes at the rally that was aborted in Chicago, and that was people with Bernie Sanders signs acting in a very irresponsible way. When you walk up to someone and you're literally 6 inches from their face and you're screaming F this and F that is beyond free speech, beyond good, legitimate political thing. And I saw that, and I saw that with my own eyes on literally hundreds of occasions on the night of that aborted rally in Chicago.
May I say one last thing?
Yes.
And I'll jump off. One of the things I learned in the Army quite quickly is they teach you there is no black, there is no white, there is no brown. Everybody is OD green, olive drab green, every single one of us. And we all took that to heart. And I never seen any racism in my entire time in the military. And I think as a country, we need to stop looking at each other as Democrats and Republicans and Independents, and we need to start looking at each other as Americans and come together as Americans. And I thank you so much for your time. And again, a wonderful, brilliant show.
Okay. Thanks very much, Rick. We appreciate it very much. Let's talk about Mike Pence. We've only got a few minutes left, at least in this segment. Mike Pence as a Republican vice presidential candidate.
The only thing
give me the
30 seconds is that when Donald Trump gave the interview, when the story was reported in the New York Times that Donald Trump Jr. had gone to John Kasich and said, I intend for my vice, how would you like to be the most powerful vice president in history? Because I intend, Donald Trump intends for his vice president to be in charge of both domestic and foreign policy. The person who he's just put in charge of domestic and foreign policy has a reactionary right-wing history and agenda.
Pence is a very reliable, established conservative that's going to help unite the party. People on the right who are concerned that Donald Trump isn't one of them are relieved and pleased to see Mike Pence on the ticket. Also, Trump said, I want a guy who has got a long experience on Capitol Hill to be my liaison to Capitol Hill, and Pence was in Congress for 10 years, so he checks that box.
Kristen. He's also, I mean, she's just fiscally conservative. So even if you don't embrace his social agenda, and yes, he acted irresponsibly with the freedom of religion issue that caught him up last year. But, I mean, he does run a state that has a 100% fully funded pension system, a balanced budget, lower unemployment than we do next door, you know, easing up on some of the business regulation that drives businesses out of Chicago. So I think fiscally, he brings kind of that common sense attitude, calm experience that the ticket needed.
Tomorrow.
I was concerned for a while about who was going to be his running mate, who would even elect to be his running mate. But I think they did make a decision that supports Donald Trump. I think it makes his candidacy stronger, and he covers a lot of the weaknesses that Trump has.
Now, you want to say something good about Ted Cruz, because I didn't see – I ran into very few people in Cleveland last week that wanted to do anything nice or say anything nice about Ted Cruz,
yes,
who I think, frankly, committed political suicide.
Well, and he may have. Now, Ted Cruz was my least – I mean, I loathed Ted Cruz as a candidate. He was my least favorite Republican candidate. But I have a lot of respect for the fact that he did tell people to vote their values, and that the man who insulted his family, his wife, and his father, he was not going to brush that aside for the sake of endorsing Trump. I thought it takes a lot of guts to say vote for your values, and he did that at the RNC.
But again, the reason he did it was because of personal reasons, not because of principle.
Well, I think
he's not
both.
Against Donald Trump because of principle. He's against Donald Trump because of a personal. Again, it's hard to deal with personal stuff. I mean, a way to do it is to do what Jeb Bush and others did. Don't show up, including John Kasich. You don't show up there.
So let me ask you a question. Why did Donald Trump allow Ted Cruz to give a speech without requiring an endorsement or anything else? In my mind, Mr. I am the world's greatest negotiator. That either means he knew exactly what he was doing, or he's actually not a great negotiator.
You know the other answer? I would say that
he knew what he was doing. He was intentional.
He did that. It was intentional, just like the big rally in Chicago. They got exactly what they
wanted. Exactly.
And the fact that he walked in and upstaged the walk-in, that wasn't coincidental either. Back shortly.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We just, during that commercial break, we took a moment of silence for Ted Cruz's career. But you were making a comment about Ted Cruz, and you were making Michael give your opinion of Ted Cruz.
The question was whether Trump had made a mistake having him speak and knowing what he was going to do, that he wasn't going to endorse. And I think that either way it went, Trump made the right decision, because Ted Cruz was a major player, major figure. People needed to hear from him. If he endorsed, Trump wins. If he doesn't, he's offending the spirit of the whole event. He's making people mad. He's losing people who liked him. And he chose that route, and the notion that maybe we need a moment of silence, he certainly didn't help himself with the Republican Party and his future.
David?
Yeah, I think my favorite part of the Ted Cruz speech was the morning after, when Donald Trump had a press conference and decided, you know what, I haven't settled all the scores. It wasn't enough that I won the Republican nomination, that I beat Ted Cruz and thrashed him, and that he got booed at the convention. No, I'm going to rehash all of it, including the part about his dad and Lee Harvey Oswald. It was stunning. Donald Trump
And then announcing that he's going to have a super PAC to try to defeat Ted Cruz and John Kasich.
And this morning he said, and one other player to be named later.
Yeah. Senator Flake, I would guess.
Set, I mean, and this is the part that moderate and even conservative Republican friends of mine cannot wrap their hands around, and that is the temperament of this man, the pettiness, the need to score settle. Dude, you won. Congratulations. Go campaign.
But see, that's how Ted Cruz felt to me that night. You know, don't have to love Donald Trump. You don't have to support him. But 10 million people voted for him. Respect the movement. Don't go to the convention and take a primetime slot and then be a jerk, which is how Peggy Noonan described him over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal. It just came across as petty, ego, score settling, and revenge.
I mean, the sad thing is Ted Cruz could have got up and basically vented all the stuff he doesn't like and still done it. He said, you know, he said things about my family. I can't forgive those things, but I made a pledge and I care about the party more than my personality. And I'm going to do the hard thing and endorse Donald Trump. He'd have been a hero.
That would be unlike Ted Cruz. I mean, Ted Cruz is known for doing what he thinks is best. I mean, he's known as being very principled. Exactly. Yes. So it would have been unlike him to have said,
Kristen said, he got a phenomenal acceptance when he walked out there. He's giving the speech. He's a good speaker. And frankly, I thought he was walking it right. I think a lot of people in the hall thought that he was walking it up to the endorsement. I think everybody was sort of shocked when he sort of turned the way that he did at the end. And that's when the boos started and they grew. In fact, and that's when Trump came in. I mean, the last 30 seconds of what he said on stage, you couldn't even hear because the boos were drowning him out.
I would say he didn't even have to say, I endorse Donald Trump. We do this a lot with editorials. I'm sure all of you do. When you write something, it's all in the writing. You can be nuanced about something.
Right.
He could have ended with, you know, we need to stop Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump is our only choice to do that. Or just said something that was not so.
Newt tried to interpret what he really meant.
Well, what I expected Ted Cruz to do when he got out there is I expected him to get out there and throw red meat to the crowd, talk about how horrific Hillary was and what a terrible presidency that would be and how what a stark choice this is. And he could have done all of that without endorsing, and he would have been a winner.
But also, he's probably still, I mean, Ted Cruz was very popular. I mean, he had a lot of support. He probably hasn't gotten over the fact that Donald Trump is the nominee.
No.
Because if it wasn't Trump, Cruz was would have been the nominee.
But again, right now, I think the thing is
over it.
He did get over it. You won to Donald Trump.
Right.
Another thing,
Michael,
to go back for a moment to the ancient history, right? 1964, Barry Goldwater is going to get clobbered. And he's too far out for a lot of people. And Rockefeller and Romney didn't back him. And they ended their careers. And Ted Cruz went that route. And the guys who knew that Goldwater was going to lose, Nixon and Reagan, stuck with him, took one for the team. They both won two presidential elections, including two 49-state landslides. You got to take it for the team, even if you're not happy about it.
And by the way, the booing in Cleveland last week, the last time I heard booing like that was in San Francisco, the Cow Palace in 1964, when Nelson Rockefeller was booed off the stage, not off the stage, but he was booed, and he was the incumbent governor. The other big night, and I would say that this was probably, even in Trump's speech, I thought the biggest enthusiastic response was to talk show host Laura Ingraham. Mm. And when she went after the news media, again, it reminded me of President Eisenhower in 1964, who was the incumbent popular president, and he's the one that pointed to the network booths and went after the media. And, of course, every 4 years somebody is going after the media. But Laura Ingraham, I thought she hit a grand slam home run, at least for that audience.
She did. She threw a lot of red meat. And she wasn't so, again, I keep going back to this idea of everything being messaged and poll tested. I mean, she did not go on that script. And boy, do they love to beat up the media. And you should see, like, when you're sitting in press row and they're ripping on the media, you know, it's a bold thing to do.
But let me ask you a question, because as a member of the media, does it concern you what Donald Trump has said about the libel laws and other things that he said that suggest that, and what he's done to the Washington Post and the other media entities who he's banned from his campaign events? Does that concern you?
I think it's petty. I mean, I think it's petty, but you know, I'm also one of probably two conservative-leaning writers, columnists in Chicago. we're a small number. It's a small caucus. So I do think there is sometimes when he makes a point about the media approaching things from a liberal point of view, I live it. I see it. And so I don't take it personally. I don't think the media should be canonized. We're not heroes. We're just regular people. When, you know, the woman got in trouble with Corey Lewandowski because he yanked her, you know, I try to just walk the line. The media sometimes does step over it.
And on the
I wonder if that reporter is going to address. Is she going to Philadelphia to address the convention?
That reporter is a right-wing Republican. No, she will not.
Oh, I thought maybe she'd be up. They'd be invited as a
Michelle Fields.
On the substance of what Trump could do, I mean, to change the libel laws, we have a U.S. Supreme Court opinion that set this. It'd be virtually impossible to actually do anything.
We're out of time. This has been a great 2 hours because we had so much to talk about. And we've got 15 Sunday nights to go before election night. And we're going to have a great 15 more great discussions like this. Our thanks to our guests for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WIND Radio. Our thanks to Colin Bobbitt and Dan Dorfman and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for a new season of Wild Travels, Saturdays at 4:30 and Sundays at 11 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through October, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.